This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices, episode 271, was recorded on May 13th, 2021. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode is brought to you by Abex Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better meet the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Genesis Volatility, provider of institutional-grade crypto options analytics. Harley Bassman returns as this week's feature interview guest. For years, Harley's been on a personal mission to figure out how to make institutional hedging tools available to retail investors, because Harley sees a risk of a long-term interest rate backup in coming years that could create a much worse threat than the 2008 financial crisis. We'll talk about the risk Harley sees, why he thinks it's so important to hedge against, and the new ETF that he's just launched in order to make runaway interest rate insurance available to everyone who wants it. Then be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after the feature interview, when Patrick and I will discuss Tesla, cryptocurrencies, and much more.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, let's jump to the S&P 500. Volatility is back. I mean, we had a pretty quick sell-off here down toward that 50-day moving average, and lots to talk about even in the post-game. But what's your take on the markets here?
Well, Patrick, let's see. What I said last week is, hey, as long as we stay above the 50-day moving average, seems to me like every time we hit it, they buy the dip. Now, it seems like they did buy the dip when we hit the 50-day moving average yesterday. And then maybe they stopped buying a little bit later on this afternoon. Let's see what the rest of the week brings and what next week brings. But I think as long as we stay either above or only a little bit below the 50-day moving average, I don't think there's any reason to think that this is anything other than another buyable dip. It's when we get below and stay below the 50-day that I start to think maybe there's a trend change.
All right, well, let's move on to that U.S. dollar index, because on that CPI number, we had quite the breakdown in the dollar. We now bounced off of where all the lows of the year came in, just around that 90 level, a little bit higher. We're back to almost approaching 91, but still in a pretty clear downtrend. You think the dollar's got more downside, or is this going to be a support that comes in here?
Patrick, no change in my outlook. I think we're in a sideways consolidation. And frankly, what is accelerating in the background is the longer term picture, the big question of whether the U.S. dollar is going to lose its reserve currency status, potentially to a digital currency. We're seeing more and more things starting to gain momentum. And so I think that the dollar question of where the U.S. dollar itself is headed strategically and its role in the monetary system is definitely going to come under serious question in coming years. But as far as dollar index, value of the dollar versus other currencies, it's consolidating sideways. I don't think there's any reason to expect anything else until we see a technical sign that something's changed.
All right, let's move on to that crude oil, because we were just yesterday approaching those year highs and looked like oil was doing great on there. And then today, just as we're recording this, we're having this $2+ breakdown in crude oil. Is in your mind this a big reversal, or is the upside still the path of least resistance here?
Well, we are testing key support right now, and so if it breaks, obviously, that's another story. I don't think it's going to. My base case is I think we're just bottoming here on a test, and I think that we're headed higher, but we'll see what happens. The thing to understand is crude oil has been trading in a fairly narrow channel since the middle of March, and we were right almost at the very top of that channel, as you said, yesterday, and then what happened really is inventory, first API kind of got things going, setting expectations for maybe a fairly big, significant drawdown in crude oil inventories, which of course would be bullish for prices. Well, that was the API private inventory data. By the time the official data came out from EIA on Wednesday, The buying in the wake of API's announcement had already taken the market pretty much to the upper limits of how far it could go. And then what happened is the EIA data came in saying, yeah, there's a drawdown, but only a very tiny one of 427,000 barrels, much, much smaller than the drawdown that API had predicted. Cushing, Oklahoma, drawing down 421,000 barrels. Gasoline building 378,000 barrels, much smaller build than API had anticipated there as well. And distillates drawing down 1.7 million barrels. U.S. production ticking up 100,000 barrels to 11 million barrels even. So at first, the prices held, at least for the first few minutes after inventory came out. But I think then the market realized, hey, you know, we didn't really get a big drawdown. The news coming out of India about the coronavirus crisis getting worse, you know, maybe demand's not going to recover quite as quick as Goldman thinks it is. It took us back down to the bottom of that established price channel. And we got there very quickly. But where we are is at the bottom of the established channel. We're still in the channel. We traded out of the channel for about 15 minutes this afternoon. And as we're speaking, still 45 minutes before the pit close. So anything could happen here. But we're right at the bottom of the channel and the five-week moving average, which are right around 63 spot 47. The top of that channel is around 67 spot 50 right now. So I think that this is a bottom and that we're about to move higher. But if we break lower from here, it would mean that the game has changed and that maybe this sideways consolidation is going to last longer. My base case, though, is we're bottoming here. Then there's going to be a little more resistance at between 66 spot 60 and $68. Probably take us a couple weeks to get through that resistance. And eventually we break out to the second major leg of a bull market fairly soon. If we see a breakdown here, and definitely this is the deciding moment right where we are today on Thursday afternoon at the bottom of the channel. If that channel breaks, then it means that that sideways consolidation is going to last a bit longer before we can look for the breakout that I eventually still see coming as this bull market continues.
All right, well, let's move on to gold and precious metals. I mean, overall, gold has held up. I mean, a little bit of a pullback in the last day or two, but really, we're still north of 1800 and still working our way generally higher in the trend. Do you think that this continues for gold?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I'm surprised that some people seem disappointed that the price is pulling back a little bit here. Let's remember what we talked about last week and what gold bulls should expect, desire, and want, which is a very, very common pattern in technical analysis, which is when you get a breakout through a significant level, such as the 100-day moving average at 1800, also round number resistance, then oftentimes what happens is there's a breakout and then you get a retest of that same number as support. We almost got it this morning, but not quite. So the fact the price of gold might go back down to $1,800 all fits the bull narrative and is therefore good news, not bad news. And the real pro move is to buy that move down to $1,800 as you get the retest of a previous resistance level now holding as support. I'm not buying any more here only because I bought quite a bit, a little bit lower, just around 1690 or so. And in terms of both bullion and mining shares, I've pretty much got my fill at this point. But this would be the technical buy spot right here, would be that retest of 1800 as support. You buy that if it proves right and it wasn't a fake breakout, which I don't think it was. I wouldn't be surprised if there's a really big move up from here.
All right, well, let's move on to the 10-year Treasury note because, well, the inflation numbers came in pretty hot, and certainly now we have the Treasury bond starting to reflect that with a little bit higher yields. You think this is a breakout where yields can start punching toward 2%, or is this going to just stall out along its previous highs?
I have to be honest, Patrick, and say I have no idea what's happening here. It's the most important thing in macro to watch is, are we in a new regime of increasing interest rates and potentially the beginning of a secular bear market in bonds? I don't think so. I don't think that's happening here. I think we're in a trading range and probably this 1.7 or so that so far has been the top is going to hold for a bit longer. But if it doesn't, it's going to bring, and especially if it goes through 2%, it's going to bring a lot of other asset markets like stocks and gold down with it.
Well, this week's feature interview guest is the convexity maven Harley Bassman. Now, Eric, why did we invite Harley back to the show this week?
Well, Patrick, this is an unusual one, and I approach this interview differently than most of the other ones that we do. Normally, the guests we get on Macro Voices, you know, I talk to them about the markets, and at the end of the interview, they get something they want to sell. Harley is the one guy who never had anything he wanted to sell. He's retired. He's a very, very successful man who invented the MOVE Index, had a very successful career in finance, and he's retired, and happily so. And he's actually gone back to work because he's so passionate, and I've been talking to him about this for years offline, he's so passionate about the idea that he has is that there is a really big macro risk on the horizon that could wipe out the savings of a lot of people. And he is just passionate about wanting to make the tools that exist in institutional finance, but not in retail products, available so that everybody has access to an ETF to protect them against a major increase in long-term interest rates in coming years. And what I think is fascinating is, why is this guy who invented the MOVE Index, obviously no slouch when it comes to the bond market, so preoccupied with this macro risk of a backing up in interest rates that he literally is coming out of retirement in order to create a product to make it better for people? So I think it's just a fascinating story that I wanted to approach a little bit differently than the average Macro Voices interview.
Eric's interview with Harley Bassman is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Abaxx Technologies. In addition to sponsoring Macro Voices, Abaxx also produces Smarter Markets, a weekly podcast that airs every Saturday morning on all the major podcast platforms. Smarter Markets brings together the leading minds in macroeconomics, technology, and commodities to explore how capital markets can be redesigned to better serve market participants and society as a whole. The second in Todd Buchholz's three-part series, Crossing the Bridge to Renewable Energy, is available now, and the series will conclude on Saturday morning with Josh Crum, founder and CEO of Abaxx Technologies. Josh is on a mission to reimagine our global market systems so that we're able to achieve the 2030 Paris Agreement objectives a year ahead of schedule. But you won't get Smarter Markets on your Macro Voices feed. You have to subscribe separately to Smarter Markets in your podcast app to listen to this free podcast.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Harley Bassman, perhaps best known as the inventor of the MOVE Index, which is basically the VIX for the bond market. Harley prepared a slide deck to accompany today's interview. Registered users will find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, it means you're not yet registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, click the red button that says Looking for the Downloads. Harley, it's great to get you back on the program, sir. It's been way too long.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
I'm going to do this interview a little bit differently today because just to put my perspective on this one, for as long as I've known you, you've been a little bit different from most of our guests. You haven't had anything to sell because you basically retired from the finance industry several years ago after being very successful at an early age and are kind of enjoying life retired and continue writing about finance just because you enjoy it and find it rewarding. You've also been preoccupied for as long as I've known you with this obsession of what's going to happen someday if interest rates explode and nobody is protected. And I know you and I have talked about this quite a bit over the years, where you've expressed great frustration that the tools needed to hedge against what you think is the biggest risk that anybody's ever, you know, seen coming in a lifetime, that may be coming in the next few years, the instruments are there, but they're only available to institutional investors. And the way I'm interpreting recent events is basically you kind of threw a tizzy fit and said, look, I'm not going to stand for this. I'm going to create a product to solve this problem. And you hooked up with our friend Mike Green. You guys both went to Simplify Asset Management in order to pull this all off. Is that right? Do I have the gist of it? And I guess we should probably dive into what is this problem that you're so worried about that's possessed you to go off and create this new product?
You got this thing exactly right. There are options or other derivatives, other ways of getting either getting risk or enhancing risk, reducing risk, tends to be available on listed form. And options on it are very short term, 1 to 3, maybe 6 months. There's some extraordinary risk profiles available in the longer dated option market or derivative market. And those are only available to professionals who have an ISDA, I-S-D-A contract. What we've tried to do over here is to pierce the ISDA veil and offer what I will call civilians, non-professionals, access to these products. And these kinds of products can really offer incredible risk management, especially options, because a 5 or 10 or 7 year option will decay in a much slower pattern than a 1, 2, 3 month option will. And we've devised a way with the help of the team at Simplify to offer these products. And we have a new one out that got launched this week.
Okay, let's talk about what the risk is that we're hedging against. What you're worried about is basically we've had a, 35 to 38 year, whatever it is, bond bull market. We're not quite positive that it's completely over, but it seems like it sure feels like it is. And someday it's going to reverse. And you're worried that a blowout in interest rates could basically destroy everybody who's not ready for it, that you'd have a whole bunch of people that have variable rate financing that's going to, you know, get adjustable rate financing that gets adjusted up, and all of a sudden everybody's crushed. Is that the basic scenario that you think is coming? Or I should ask, is it something that you think is coming, or is it just a risk you think people should be protected against?
I think we can go to the bar and kick around whether rates are going up or down and the path they're going to be in the next year, 2 or 3, and we have a fine discussion. But that actually is not what really worries me. The greater risk is not that rates go up or not, although they can, and the single purpose of rates go up so bond prices go down or discount rates change. It's that if we get interest rates above a certain level, the correlation of stocks to bonds will flip. And that's been the biggest deal in the last 20 years. Is that you've seen stock and bond prices go in opposite directions. So stocks up, bonds down, and vice versa. So they kind of hedge each other. This not only has underpinned the 60-40 portfolio, right? 60% stocks, 40% bonds, but it's actually grown this business called risk parity. Bridgewater was the biggest user of this. Congratulations, it was a genius idea. And what they would do is they wouldn't take $100 and do 60-40. They take $100 and do 130 of bond and 70 of stock, or some other ratio depending upon the correlation, and offered a levered return to people using this inverse correlation of stocks to bonds. And it turns out this correlation seems to be very much related to interest rates or inflation or both. So if you look at page 3 of the handout, here's one version of the stock-to-bond correlation offered by our friend Gerard Minnick, who's been on your show. If you go to the next page, here's another story about the stock-to-bond correlation from a different vendor. And what the result is that if rates go somewhere above 3.5, 4.5, somewhere in there, you will see this stock-to-bond correlation flip. And you'll see stocks and bonds go up and down in unison. There'll no longer be any hedge value to your bond portfolio. And if you're a levered investor where you have $200 of assets supported by $100 of money, well, now things can get really scary. And if you go look at the last 2 times we've seen real market drawdowns, last March, a year ago March, and then before that, 2018, you saw stocks and bonds go down together. And when that happens, things went really haywire. Because all of a sudden, all these various funds that were levered would have to de-lever themselves. And of course, if people are not hedged properly, that can get rather bothersome. And so what I see over here is, do I think rates are going to go up? Yes. Why do I think that? We could talk about that in a few minutes. But the big idea is this. If we get rates above a certain level, let's call it 4.25%, you're going to see this correlation reverse. And if that happens, it's going to be a financial tsunami. I can't tell you how concerned people should be about this, because everything will go down. And many of your past guests have spoken about margin and leverage and short out there, all these various things about how we're levered up, the debt we have in the country overall, public and private, all this leverage is kind of based upon this correlation in the last 20 years. And if that reverses, that's the problem. And so I want to find a way to go protect myself against that.
Okay, so we've got kind of a double whammy here, because first of all, if interest rates back up, that causes a bunch of problems by itself. Money's getting more expensive. But on top of that, if it leads to this reversal in correlation, well, now I got the value of my bond portfolios going down because interest rates are rising, and all of a sudden stocks are going down at the same time because the correlation has flipped. And that's where I've really got, and if that's not just happening to me, but happening to everyone else around me, all the other market participants are having that same experience. That's the financial tsunami that you're talking about. How big of a tsunami? Are we talking about bigger than the 2008 financial crisis? How big of a tsunami is it? And how much of a difference do you think you can really make by hedging against it?
I have not put pencil to paper on how big this could be, how much stocks can go down by. I just know that when you reverse that, people are going to lose the ability to go and ride their portfolios, because all of a sudden you're not going to have offsetting gains to dampen the overall present value of what you own. They'll both be going down, and people are not going to be used to that. People are pretty much used to there being, you know, you see a bad headline, but they'll make money on one side of the portfolio and not make it on the other. So I haven't sized this yet, but the evidence is when we've seen this correlation reverse, so stocks and bonds move in unison, those have been the biggest moves we've seen in the last number of years. And I would say in particular that the high value or high number FANG stocks will be especially susceptible, because if you think about it, theory has been proposed that your big tech stocks, the big growth stocks, they're going to make a lot of money someday. Someday being 10, 20, 30 years from now. Okay, that's fine. I mean, we've seen Amazon go from doing nothing to being gigantic, so that kind of worked. If you have these companies with very distant cash flows, and you're discounting those cash flows back 30 years at 1%, well, that's worth a lot of money. You discount it back at 4%, it's worth a lot less. And so if you had a situation where equities were going down and the high value, long duration stocks went down, that would be a real problem to people, which worries me. I mean, I kind of view these FANG stocks as being like 70-year duration bonds, and they performed very well with that consideration. But if rates really go up, I suspect they will have a significant headwind.
Now, you said in passing, you know, you wanted to protect yourself from this. You already knew how to protect yourself from this. You've got the institutional background to know how to put this trade on, and you have a personal ISDA account. So obviously, this has become something of a mission for you. You don't just want to protect yourself. You want to make this tool available to everybody so they can protect themselves too. What's driving that? I mean, was it just got bored with retirement, or is this just a passion of yours that you want people to be able to protect themselves? You see this as a really big risk. What's driving you to have kind of come out of retirement in order to do this project?
I will not be drawn into any kind of discussion of politics. That's a loser no matter what I say. But I do have a public policy bent where I do think that we should offer ways to help people optimize or at least protect themselves against various outcomes that they're not prepared for. And this is a way to go and do that for lots of people. And these products are available in the market. And this actually, in some sense, is a market benefit, because these options are so very inexpensive because there's no buyers of them. But there are sellers. Why there are sellers is a different story. But there are sellers out there and have made options extraordinarily cheap. And we might want to go through that in a little bit.
Harley, let's talk about what this product, this ETF that you and Mike Green are developing. Is it for people like me? Is it for investors? And how would I use it? Do I basically buy a proportion of, you know, certain percentage of my net worth in order to hedge myself against future higher rates? How does it pay off? And who is this for?
I'll try to be careful over here, seeing as our regulations of what I can and can't say. We have a new ETF that's come out there, was launched this week. You can find it on the Simplify website. And what it is, it's launched at $50 a share. It's $25 of a 7-year option on the 20-year interest rate. It's kind of like buying a 7-year option on a 20-year treasury. Struck at 4.25%, and it's $12 of a 7-year treasury security, which is not going to move all that much. And the idea is you buy this thing, it has roughly, let's say, $1,000 of option per share. So if you bought 1,000 shares, that would be equal to owning options on $1 million of bonds, and it would perform as such. And if you go look at my latest commentary on page 4, you'll see a modeled profile of this ETF relative to a futures contract. And it's rather fancy in terms of what it does. The downside's about the same. The upside is, you know, triple what it can do. It's a very transparent. We're not hedging it. We're not managing it. You are just basically buying almost straight through processing to owning a 7-year option. And what's fancy about this is the implied volatility for a 7-year option is almost 10% below that for a 5-year option. So the volatility actually goes up. So the decay of this is relatively small over time. So the idea is to buy this trade, put it in your book, hold it for, you know, a number of years, 2, 3, 4 years is the idea. And as a giant insurance policy against a financial portfolio. But you could also, if you were a contractor, a developer, and you're building a mid-size multifamily, and you get your construction loan, and you can't get permanent financing for 3 years until the project's complete, the value of that project is very dependent upon where you get your permanent financing. And if rates went up by, you know, 2 points, that might wipe out the entire profit of this thing. If you are a homeowner and you have an adjustable rate mortgage and it's going to go and reset in 3 years, you could buy this and hedge your portfolio out. It solves all the problems of there's nothing else out there that has this consistency, transparency, stability, and directness. The only thing that's even close would be futures contracts, and that requires a lot of accounting, separate accounts to do it, and you have to roll the contract every quarter. It's very, very problematic. So this really solves so many problems for people.
So essentially what you've done is you've done the analysis to look at where you think the macro risks are, and you're saying that the instrument, if people had access to institutional finance instruments that they ought to buy for their own portfolios, if they had access to that market, is basically a put on treasuries at approximately a 4.25% interest rate, where it's paying off if at the end of 7 years, if interest rates have moved above 4.25%, there's a big payoff there. It's a protective insurance policy. What you've done is just dialed in the parameters and turned it into an ETF so that anybody on Robinhood can buy it in their Robinhood account if they want to. I would imagine the Robinhood crowd probably doesn't understand what it is. But anybody who understands what it is can just buy it as an ETF, and they've got that protection. You've taken care of dialing in the right parameters to get the right instrument.
It is point and click, right into a regular account. And it is piercing the ISDA veil and allowing civilians access to professional products.
Harley, let's talk then about why individuals would need to pierce that veil in the first place. Specifically, what could go wrong in terms of systemic risks in the market if interest rates start to run away in the next few years? And what do we need to be concerned with? What do we need to watch for in terms of why that might be coming?
I mean, the case for why rates may go up in the next 2 or 3 years has been explained over and over again on this show, so there's no reason to repeat that. What I will say is this: the people who push back and say the Fed doesn't want that, I disagree. I think the Fed actually does want a steeper curve, and they do want higher long-term rates. Not the front end, but I do not think you're going to have yield curve control of the 1950s, where they hold the back end of the curve down. And there's so many good public policy reasons for this. If you steepen the curve, you help the banking system. Now, I'm not going to call the major banks the good guys here, but the financial system will improve with a steeper curve. You will increase profits, will expand their capital cushion, and that is a public policy good. And so that is supportive. And we are a financial economy. We're a levered financial economy, and making sure the plumbing works is very important. It'll improve the pension systems that we have, right? Pension and insurance are long liability people. They owe their money out way in the future. Higher rates, higher long-term rates will reduce the funding gap in pensions and insurance companies. So that's good. To the extent that we have a huge cohort of people who are retiring soon, by taking rates down as they have for the last decade, you kind of robbed Peter to pay Paul. People who are savers have had their savings, the income they get reduced, and that benefit's gone to borrowers. A steeper curve, higher rates in the back end would be helpful to people who are retiring because they'd have earned more interest. And that in turn would perhaps reduce the government cost of public assistance for people who are retiring. Finally, most important for, I think, the people on this show, who are probably all in pretty good shape, is a steeper curve will pass along information about the market. The yield curve has been historically the best predictor of the economy. You might recall that I predicted a recession for the first quarter of 2020 at the end of 2018 when the curve first inverted. And lo and behold, 18 months later, it happened. Now, does it count that a virus occurred? Maybe not, but it did happen. And this has been the best prediction, is the yield curve. And so therefore, allowing the curve to move via market conditions will cue people into risks coming or not. It'll improve, it'll make people more cautious, and they'll hedge. They won't be as exposed. And so that's a public policy good also.
Tell me about the pricing of this. Presumably, if you're using institutional traded products, there's some efficient price discovery. So I would imagine there's reasonably efficient pricing for this protection that this ETF offers.
Well, I guess there might be if the Fed didn't have their big finger on the scale. In the same manner that the yield curve has been the best predictor correlation to the economy, so has the yield curve been very well correlated with implied volatility. The cost of risk, the cost of insurance, the cost of options is driven by implied volatility. And if you look at page 7, one of my favorite charts, you can see that the yield curve has steepened a lot. That's the orange line. But implied volatility, the purple line, has not gone up. I think this is because the Fed has basically, well, one, been supporting the market, but they're supporting it with both words and deeds. But I don't think this is actually long-term viable. I think implied vols have to rise as people become more and more concerned. And what's really strange is this. Going to page 8, this is the term surface, the implied volatility level for a 3-month option, a 1-year, a 5-year, a 10-year option. Look at that green line, at the slope of the green line, and how it goes up. Because as you go more into the future, it's further away, you can't see as well, and you have more uncertainty. And therefore, the price of insurance, the price of uncertainty should also rise. And it did. But look at the most recent snapshot. See how this ball is flattened out. You've seen long dated options, 10-year options come down. This is totally anomalous considering that we've gone through massive increase in the Fed balance sheet with this double-barreled fiscal program, soon to be maybe one or two more of them. It is greatly uncertain what's going to happen. We've never seen us grow the balance sheet and spend this much money, grow this much debt before. Will it be higher or lower rates? We can argue about that, but the uncertainty has to have gotten greater right now, and therefore it's totally anomalous that vols come down for long-dated options. Next page. This is options on the European SX5E, the Dow 50. See how much that vol's come down. In Japan, currency options, same thing. They've come down very hard. And then finally, page 11, this is where the real value proposition is. This is the implied volatility of interest rates. Implied volatility of the 20-year interest rate going from a 1-month option out to a 10-year option. And notice how it's actually inverted. It's a longer story about why this is the case, market conditions, and this and that. All you have to know is It's pointing south. As far as I'm concerned, it should be going north. And when you get this inverted volatility term surface, it becomes very inexpensive to buy this insurance against a great uncertainty. So it's really not a matter of predicting that rates are going to go higher or that things are going to go and get crazy. It's a matter of the insurance is so cheap relative to a very costly risk outcome, you should buy it.
So how do you envision this product being used? Is it primarily individual investors putting it in their portfolios, or is it institutional portfolio managers saying, okay, I need, you know, X number of shares of Harley's ETF in order to hedge this particular risk in some other fund that they're managing, for example?
The two largest buyers I expect are going to be family office or high net worth individuals who have significant exposure to higher rates. I mean, people who don't have large bank accounts or large investment accounts, I suppose they can get hurt by higher rates, but that's very indirectly. It's people who have assets. Insurance and pension companies are not going to buy this because they actually want higher rates, right? Because they discount their liabilities and collapses that asset liability gap for them. Hedge funds tend not to be buyers because they're very short-term oriented. They don't have a macro thought when they're looking out into the future. I mean, some of them do, but most are very short-term nips to blips. So you're going after people who have assets, who have risk, and have the capability to go and appreciate the risks of doing this. So that's probably the target audience here. And the sizing is fairly simple. 1,000 shares is roughly an option on $1 million of options. So it kind of, in your head, kind of works pretty easily.
So is the prescription then that you base it on your net worth? If your net worth is $5 million, then you need 5,000 shares, or how does that work?
Well, I'd love that, but no. I think you would base it on, you'd look at the asset portfolio you have and how many of those assets would be at risk if rates went up by 200 or 300 basis points. And I think most people who have reasonable assets kind of have an idea of what's going to move and what's not going to move relatively. So if you own, I mean, if you have a lot of like commercial real estate, things that trade at class A buildings, which is a different animal entirely, but people who have any kind of rental property, they could be seriously harmed with higher rates if they ever wanted to sell. If they're going to hold it to maturity forever for the family, forget it. But if you might want to sell this asset someday, the cap rate is going to change. And these are very long duration assets, and they will go down in price pretty hard if rates go up a lot and you have to go and try and sell them. I mean, ultimately, this strategy is not for someone who's certain rates are going to go up. Those people have already sold the market. These are people, it's insurance against an outcome that is not, you know, a certainty, but is a very expensive outcome. I mean, you don't buy home insurance because you think your house is going to burn down. You buy it because if it did, you'd be very sad.
Okay, Harley. So this is not designed to speculate on the direction of interest rates. We use futures for that. This is a hedge designed to protect my portfolio against an unexpected move if it happens.
The word speculative or speculate has weird connotations to it, most of them negative. If you want to use the word speculate in the term of a two-year horizon, this is fine. This is a longer-term macro exposure to higher interest rates. So if you want to go and bet that rates are going to be higher a year or two or three from now, this is almost the only way you can do it. If you want to go and trade Friday's payroll number, don't call me on this. Go and trade futures. So it's really, it's more of a horizon concept than it is a something else.
Harley, we haven't talked about inflation yet. That seems like a big part of this equation because an expectation of inflation is certainly a reason to expect increasing interest rates.
You know, this whole idea of inflation and interest rates kind of gets, you know, conflated with each other. They're kind of two different things. It is possible to have inflation and not have higher rates. The Fed can control interest rates by buying them, which is what they've been doing. I mean, right now, we have a negative real interest rate here, as well as in Europe and Japan. So they don't go hand in hand. But and this particular product that we're talking about, it pays off as interest rates go up, not as inflation goes up. So there is the scenario where if the Fed really, you know, bought every bond available, that you could have inflation go up and rates not move. So that is something to be careful about. But I do want to make one more comment here, that I'm greatly disturbed by this idea of people saying there has not been inflation. We've had people who, 10 years ago talking about if the Fed prints this much money, we're going to get inflation. And I'm a UChicago graduate, man. I believe in monetary theory. MV equals PQ equals GDP. And we have taken M's way up here. And the idea that we have not had inflation is totally, completely false. I can't be more clear about that. It is totally bogus. We've had inflation, just not in CPI. We've had inflation in housing. And you can see that on page one. Look at this over here. You've seen housing prices explode higher. They're well over where they were at the peak in 06. Yet, the owner's equivalent rent that they use for CPI, that hasn't gone anywhere. We've had inflation in stocks, in bonds, in gold, in art, in jewelry, everything. I mean, there's been massive inflation now. Unfortunately, as a public policy concept, inflation has gone towards assets that 1% owns. So that really hasn't worked. The Fed's idea was to create inflation for middle-class wages. And that has so far has not occurred. But to say we haven't had inflation is false. It just wasn't in CPI. What I think is going to happen is the Fed working with the fiscal policy, this time it's going to go and work. When they increased assets before, it stayed in the financial system and inflated stocks and bonds and other assets like that. The money did not go to the people who spend. It went to people who have money, whose propensity to spend the extra dollar is rather thin. These fiscal policies are going to go to people who have to spend money and will spend it. A Fed study from a few years ago showed that 40% of the population could not conjure up $400 for an emergency. That's terrible. That's just really terrible. But nonetheless, it is a fact. And if these people go and get money from the fiscal policy government, it will get spent. And I think that's what's going to go and finally drive inflation, CPI inflation higher, and interest rates higher. So that's my core thought on this. And there are others who disagree, but, that's why we have bars to go and drink at.
Harley, tell me a little bit more about how you and our friend Mike Green got together, because frankly, last I knew, you've been retired officially from finance, enjoying your retirement and talking, as long as I've known you, about how badly this product is needed. Is this just something you had to do? I mean, is this about making a buck for you, or is this about really wanting to see this product come to realization?
Oh, the latter. I want this product to exist. I mean, I'm making money, but I mean, I would like this to exist because as a public policy good, it is helpful to people. I also like the idea, if you really look at what an ETF is, the original idea is you're taking some kind of open-end fund, which you can only trade at 4 o'clock every day, and putting it onto an exchange so you can trade it whenever you want all day long. That's the first generation. The next generation was people like buying puts or selling calls on these embedded ETFs. It's a very static strategy. That was a little helpful. It kind of bent the edges of the profile of an ETF. Simplify why I joined them, and I can show you why Mike Green joined also with me, and we are personal friends, by the way, for quite a while, is that you're taking this next level of actually really moving dynamically the profile of an asset by looking at the options and managing the options that you have in them, or by offering these long-dated options via piercing the ISDA veil. This is entirely new. This is a brand new area, and it suits both of us very well because we both really appreciate the dynamic of unbalanced leverage, right? When you buy an option, you have limited loss, unlimited gain. And we're both pretty good at locating where value is and then sizing it appropriately. So I think the Simplify Asset Management, this could be the real deal, man. And I mean, was I retired? I wasn't earning a W-2, I'll give you that. Retired, not quite. I was publishing. But I did, I'll say it, get back to a real job because it's just so interesting. This is a startup operation. I'm employee number 10. Mike's employee number 12. It's really exciting to go get involved in this and really create new products that are actually interesting and viable. And by the way, our fee structure, if you go look at that, is very low compared to other products out there that even try to replicate what we're doing.
Well, Harley, my hat is off to you and Mike. So the gist of it is basically it's 1,000 shares per million of principal that you want to protect against the risk of higher future interest rates, and it's a 7-year embedded option that's behind that ETF. Harley, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. For our listeners who want to find out more about the ETF or more about what you and Mike are doing, where can they contact you?
Well, you can find us at simplify.us. That's our company website. You can find my commentaries, still published independently, at convexitymaven.com. If you want to get on my list, just send me an email. I'm glad to do it. And I'll tell you that you should keep your eyes open because, you know, Mike and I and the team there, we have some very clever ideas about how to offer some products that will have much better path dependency outcomes, as well as offering some new ISDA-type products for foreign currencies or other things where you get access to long-dated options, long-dated investment profiles. So these are all coming up very soon. Keep your eyes open, and I think you'll be very pleased.
Well, Harley, we look forward to getting you back on the show in a few months for another update. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor. Yes, cryptocurrencies do have options. Both Bitcoin and Ethereum have active options markets. Genesis Volatility, also known as GVOL, is an institutional-grade crypto options analytics provider. You can view option SKUs, implied volatility, open interest, and volume metrics for free by visiting their website, gvol.io. That's GVOL.io. Professional traders can also choose to upgrade to a paid account to access historical data, model realized volatility, monitor block trades, and much more using GVOL's professional tools. GVOL is a leader in the crypto options space and is used by the largest professional firms currently making crypto markets.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Harley back, and I actually am really excited about his product. You know, the ability to actually get the convexity of options in an interest rate play that has this kind of duration is something that I've never had access to because I don't have an ISDA account. So this is definitely something that's perked my interest. I'm going to be looking into it as we go forward. Anyway, let's take a look at some of these charts.
Listeners, you'll find the download link for the post-game chart deck in your Research Roundup email. Now, if you don't have a Research Roundup email, that means you haven't registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, look for the red button that says Looking for the Downloads on the homepage. Patrick, let's dive in. The chart deck is titled Sector Rotation or Start of a Bigger Correction. Well, we hit the 50-day, actually the 55-day moving average pretty perfectly yesterday on the S&P. What's the story here? Is it a sector rotation or the start of a bigger correction?
So, Eric, you're absolutely right. We hit that 50-day moving average. It was something you talked about at the market wrap. And all throughout the start of the year, we've repetitively in this segment of the show talked about what happens when the market approaches this level. And it often has emerged as a buy-on-dip opportunity. And so the big question is, will we see the markets do this and again, where we're going to have a new buy on dip opportunity emerge here? And, you know, one of the things that worries me about this is that when we go to page 3 and look at that NASDAQ, we are now definitively broken below that 50-day. And one of the things that we've seen on the NASDAQ was that it has acted in the past as the leadership sector. And so while we continue to watch this S&P 500 approaching that support, it does have to be a red flag, the fact that a major indice with so many of those mega cap tech names in them not being able to hold the line in that area. And more importantly, it wasn't even able to really make any progress above its February history highs on that upside. What is interesting, and one thing that I want to continue to watch closely, is on page four, when we actually look at the NASDAQ over the S&P 500 ratio. And one of the things that has been in place for many, many years has been the structural outperformance of the NASDAQ over that of the S&P 500. And that has generally been a great trade to just be long the tech. And what we've seen, and you know, Harley talked about it as well, is that, you know, a lot of these tech names are considered long duration assets, and with interest rate pressures and other things, we're seeing sector rotation being so dominant. And the question now is, are we seeing a bigger picture, a more secular turn in this trend where the NASDAQ may no longer outperform the S&P 500 moving forward? And I think that whether or not inflation is transitory or whether it's more secular is going to be an important part of that.
Patrick, let's look at an inflation chart then on page five.
Right. And so we obviously had that really hot print of inflation come in. And more importantly, it's a very big print. It's on a 10-year chart, the biggest breakout in inflation that we had. And many people are just trying to suggest that it is transitory, and rightfully so. Commodities have been very hot, and it has been creating that short-term pressure on pushing inflation numbers higher. But what if some of our guests that talk about this being more of a secular trend, what if they end up being right, and that we, in fact, do have a lot of pressure on inflation continuing and moving forward? And that's where I want to go back to that Harley comment when Harley was talking about that the FANG stocks, which I have on page six, are considered in his mind something like 70-year duration bonds. They're these growth assets that discount all their future earnings. And when you have interest rate pressure, the multiples get pressured on them, and they suddenly have huge headwinds. And so when we're looking at that NASDAQ over the S&P chart on page four, and then we look at what's happening in these FANG stocks, it's going to be one of the single most important questions to answer as to whether or not this almost decade-long trend of NASDAQ outperformance, whether that has come to an end, and whether we're going to see the cyclicals really continue to take over as the leadership in the stock market moving forward.
Patrick, I love chart five, and the reason is it's finally starting to show that the data are reflecting something that all the smart people in the room have known for a long time, which is a secular inflation is beginning. And sure, it's been true that it hasn't been reported in the data yet. Well, now we're finally starting to see it in the data. And the reason that's so significant is all the people that are blind to the macro factors that have just been saying, you guys talking about inflation are crazy. There's nothing in the data to say that. Now, people who think that way are finally going to have the evidence they need to start recognizing something that's obvious to people who understand cause and effect, which is big inflation coming. So I think the fact that it's finally showing up in the data is really significant, because it's going to wake up the part of the market that hasn't been paying attention to what a lot of us think is obvious.
Right. And so on that point, what I wanted to do is show page seven, where we have the metals and mining ETF over the S&P 500. And to almost the exact opposite of the NASDAQ over the S&P, the metals and mining ETF has massively underperformed the S&P 500 for many, many years. And what we've seen is that as all of these commodity bull markets have started and all these commodities have turned, suddenly we're seeing that this sector, the cyclical sector of the stock market, has materially outperformed. And again, is it transitory? Is this a short-term thing? Or is this going to be the trend that may even last for years and this sector outperform over that of the major indices? And whether this rotation is underway and whether this shift in the markets is obviously a lot to do with answering that inflation question. But this is certainly something I think is important, because so many people are not positioned in their portfolios for this.
Patrick, I don't know how you can say not positioned in their portfolios. We have some portfolios, like the ARK ETF, that are prepared for an entirely new paradigm that's beyond my comprehension. But I did see an interview where I know that ETF in particular is got superior portfolio construction and can't lose.
Well, you know, Eric, what I really wanted to talk about when we were putting up this ARK Innovation ETF chart was just to really show that sector rotation has really come underway. I mean, the ARK ETF was taking huge money inflow throughout most of 2020 and was one of the best performing funds out there during that cycle. But since that January, February highs, this has been just actively distributed. And one of their largest holdings, which is still a 10% weighting, is Tesla, which is on page 9. And one of the big things to watch is as we see all these cyclicals and financials and value plays all take all the money inflow, have we seen major tops in these stocks? And is this distribution that has been going on for several months just the beginning of a much deeper correction in these? I mean, Tesla at this stage is under 600. And if this type of distribution cycle continues, it'll be really interesting to see whether or not we see a correction that can have this down even in the $500 and $400 range in the coming months. And so that's going to be something to watch, particularly with the type of attention that Elon Musk is getting today. Now, Eric, one of the things that Elon Musk has been doing recently is been talking crypto, and certainly he's been one of the torchbearers, to the whole movement of crypto over the last half a year, and really kind of changed his tune a little bit, and certainly creating some controversy in that space that caused Bitcoin to reverse on the downside. We were trading near 50,000 at the time when I snapped this chart, and it really looks like Bitcoin is getting incredibly heavy. One thing with these cryptos that are, in my mind anyway, that is required is momentum, because there has to be that excitement and the froth and that air of easy money that keeps momentum there. And Bitcoin really has seemed to run out of a little bit of that momentum and juice. And it'll be really interesting to see whether this is where that resistance really establishes itself on the crypto. What's your take on it?
Patrick, I think it's pretty clear that the factors that are affecting crypto markets are similar to the factors that were affecting the dot-com market in the late 90s. You got a whole bunch of people who have no clue how any of this stuff actually works, guessing, trying to figure out what's important, and obsessed with trying to get on the next thing, whatever is hot. This most recent nonsense from Elon Musk about how he supposedly just developed a conscience about the amount of electricity which is wasted by Bitcoin is just utter nonsense. It has nothing to do with the big picture. We are in the very early stages of a digital currency revolution. It's a story that's much bigger than Bitcoin. And frankly, what's happening right now in terms of every single cryptocurrency trade which has ever occurred is it's all very early stage speculation in a very unpredictable and wild market. Where this is really headed is not clear yet, but what's clear to me is the odds of Bitcoin being a big part of the story are much lower than the Bitcoin crowd seems to think they are.
You know, what's interesting about that, Eric, is that Bitcoin has always been the largest and one that has gained the most attention. But there is now rifts between many coiners that are basically either supporting Ethereum or Dogecoin. And so I have charts on page 11 and 12 of the other cryptos out there. And what's interesting is that there has been very clear bullish momentum in Ethereum, which has still remained very decisively in trend. And certainly the Dogecoin has certainly also been getting a lot of attention on page 12 and working as well. So it's interesting that while we can argue that Bitcoin has lost a lot of that momentum, what is interesting is that there are still cryptocurrencies out there that are doing half decent.
Well, and I think if you wanted to analyze this in any meaningful way, the comparison of the relative performance of these different currencies is much more interesting than the absolute performance of the group. And certainly looking at the contrast between page 10 and page 11, I think you're finally starting to see a little bit of market realization of something that's frankly been obvious to anybody with a technology background for years, which is Ethereum has always been technologically superior, more functional, more flexible platform for not just digital currency, but an entire decentralized finance future, which is coming. Ethereum has always been better. The number of people who knew that was small enough that the price of Bitcoin, which has always been more popular and which certainly was first, was ahead. So now we see a little bit of market recognition of technological superiority, but you don't even know if that's really what's driving it because, frankly, the Dogecoin thing, as I understand it, Patrick, Dogecoin is literally just another cryptocurrency. Somebody literally just took the source code and copied it and made a joke out of it and said, look, I created my own cryptocurrency. And they said, hey, did it as a joke, but made money on it. And, you know, all of a sudden it's back, really just because Elon, I think, says it's back. So you look at what I think is driving the Ethereum price. I think that really is a recognition by smart people that Ethereum is more suitable than Bitcoin as being the basis of decentralized finance solutions in the real world. The Dogecoin thing, I think, is Elon talking up nonsense, something that never made any sense and suddenly got popular because Elon started talking it up. So we're at a very, you know, we're at the infancy of this market, and it's still being driven by factors that have very little to do with logic and rational assessment and much more to do with herds and trends and people getting excited about things they don't understand. Very similar to the late 90s with the dot-com stocks. I just want to remind everyone as we close that if you want, you can get Patrick's chart text not just once a week, but every day with a free trial of Big Picture Trading, Patrick's service. You can find out more at bigpicturetrading.com or on page 13 of the slide deck. We're going to leave it there for this week's episode. This episode is brought to you by Abex Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better meet the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Genesis Volatility, provider of institutional-grade crypto options analytics. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's research roundup.
This week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to the Harley Bassman slides and the chart book we just discussed here in the postgame. There's also a link to an oil price article on America's multi-trillion dollar infrastructure security crisis, and as well as a link to a Jesse Felder piece on gold's recent headwind shifts to a tailwind. And so you'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend, that's Eric spelt with a K, and myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.